listening to Truth To You with Jono, and g'day wherever you may be around the world. It's good to have your company. It's time for Natural Medicine with Stephen Tamplin of CentralWestNaturopathic.com. G'day, Stephen.
G'day, Jono, and all the listeners.
Thank you for joining us again today, my friend. Boy, we've got a little bit to get through. And today we're going to be addressing and speculating on some of the questions in the comments left by listeners from our last discussion. But before we get there, Stephen, I'd like to just briefly, if I can, talk about an article that was in the Sydney Morning Herald, I do believe, and this is by Kelly Burke. Well, I'll just read a little bit of this. It says, more than 400 doctors, medical researchers and scientists have formed a powerful lobby group to pressure universities to close down alternative medicine degrees. Almost one in three Australian universities now offer courses in some form of alternative therapy or complementary medicine, including natural Chinese herbal medicine, chiropractics, homeopathy, naturopathy, reflexology, aromatherapy. That's just some of the ones that they mentioned, Stephen. I also believe they mentioned acupuncture and a couple of others. But the new group, this is the name, their name is called Friends of Science in Medicine. Friends of Science in Medicine wrote to vice chancellors this week warning that by giving undeserved credibility to what in many cases would be better described as quackery, and by, quote, failing to champion evidence-based science and medicine, the universities are trashing their reputation as bastions for scientific rigor. John Dwyer of the University of New South Wales, who is also a government advisor on consumer health fraud, said it was distressing that 19 universities were now offering degrees in pseudoscience. That's quoted from him, pseudoscience. It's deplorable, he goes on to say, that we didn't realize how much concern there was out there for universities' reputations until we tapped into it, Professor Dwyer said. We're saying enough is enough. Taxpayers' money should not be wasted on funding these courses, nor should government health insurance rebates be wasted on this nonsense. He calls it nonsense. He calls it this article refers to it as quackery and pseudoscience. What do you have to say to that?
Well, there are three parts to the answer, Jono, and this is not new. People have been exercising their freedom of choice for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And I guess this is an attack on that freedom of choice. If you prevent people from training in natural medicines, mm-hmm. then, of course, you're going to mean that people don't have that choice anymore and they are forced down a pathway which has got a fixed ideology. Now, I guess my position is that as medical practitioners are trained in medical science, health practitioners such as naturopathy and those who get a degree in health science are actually healthcare practitioners. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's a difference between medicine and health. And I guess if you parallel it to a person who wants to build a house, do you have to have a double brick house with a concrete floor, or can you go straw bale if you want to?
You can go straw bale if you want to.
Because you have that choice. Mm-hmm. If you want to buy a car, do you have to buy from General Motors, or can you go and choose to buy from a Ford?
You can choose.
It's a matter of personal choice. Mm-hmm. Now, in respect of these people who call themselves Friends of Science in Medicine, I have no problem with them having this science in medicine, because the word science comes from the Greek root for the word knowledge.
Yes.
And the knowledge that there is in medicine is good and fine, and there's no doubt that in acute stages there is a place for acute medicine, mm-hmm. and some of the pharmacological issues, as we spoke on last time. But when we go back to evidence-based science or evidence-based knowledge, how long have people been on this planet, to the best of your knowledge?
Oh, well, from our perspective, at least 6,000 years.
Or more, according to other cultures and thoughts. And those people have been eating foods. Now, they know that if they go down the bush or wherever they go and they eat a particular type of berry and someone gets sick or they die, they know not to go and eat it again. If two people go down and eat it and they die, then there's some evidence that it's not going to work for you.
Sure.
So there's evidence-based stuff that's gone back thousands of years. And I recall when I was studying acupuncture in Hong Kong, we had a group of medical practitioners on an excursion from the United States come to the institute where I was studying in Kowloon. And they were making some nonsense about this pseudoscience and quackery and there's no evidence that the needle does anything. Mm-hmm. And the course master, who was a very humble man, he said, well, It's interesting you should say that, because we've got in 985 BC, the Yellow Emperor in China got his court physicians to come up with this book of internal medicine. So there was nearly 3,000 years of recorded history about nutrition, natural medicine, acupuncture, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, it's very important that you understand that you can't have a philosophy or a dogma going along which can con everybody. You know, if acupuncture didn't work 900 years BC, why is it going to work now? Mm-hmm. It's because its continuity has shown efficacy. But what he showed and what he said to those group was that when you consider Western medicine, it's been around for about 150 years. So in the scene of altogether health management, it's still relatively experimental.
Mm.
And what we see is the evidence that it's experimental is there was a time when doctors encouraged you to smoke to regulate your blood pressure. There was a time when doctors would prescribe HRT till they found out it was causing cancers, mm-hmm. heart attacks and strokes. Then the same thing with these anti-inflammatories. Now we're seeing the same thing with immunization, where back when medicine was trying to come up with the polio vaccine, they got the polio virus and they mixed it with the simian monkeys' kidneys in mince form, and they developed this vaccine which found to have the SV40 virus, which is mutated into all sorts of other negative health outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
So on the same basis as that, I have with me an article from a US doctor of medicine who has done some studies through various facilities. And he's found out that most pediatricians don't vaccinate their children because they don't like the side effects of vaccines.
Sure.
Found that a lot of oncologists, that is cancer specialists, won't take the treatments if they get a malignancy because they don't want that either.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of the evidence, they have concerns about the way it goes.
Mm.
Now, surely if you're going to consider how people are going to be required to provide good outcomes in the health or medical care,
mm-hmm.
you need to first of all make sure that the courses are decent and valid. I have no problem with that. And on an international basis, if you're registered in one country, most likely you can get registered in another.
Mm-hmm.
And just recently, there was a situation of an overseas doctor here in our area who'd been prosecuted by the Healthcare Complaints Commission for not having sufficient knowledge and experience or skill to do his job.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a matter which was now a matter of public record, that if you've got people making these claims, it's got to be evidence-based and they're the only people who can get it right, why do alternatives exist?
Exactly. It's so true. And as you started off, it is a matter of freedom of choice in this so-called free and democratic society in which we live. People in universities are opting to take these courses because they want to, because they believe that there is validity to these courses and that it's beneficial. Why
and
should
universities also are meeting the demand?
They're meeting the demand. That's
for
exactly
the people
right.
Who want to learn these things, and they're doing it on a standardized measure,
yes. Yeah.
Where they can go to a university or a health school or whatever it might be, and learn within parameters
mm-hmm.
certain information which can be used. Now, there are some doctors of medicine who are very, very good. No doubt about that.
Mm.
There are some doctors of medicine who are not as good.
Sure.
You never hear anybody saying, I go to the worst doctor in town. Everyone says, oh, I go to the best doctor. Right?
Yes.
You know, my specialist is number one in his field. Mm. You're not going to find someone saying, oh, I go to the 27th specialist in his field. Okay?
Sure.
Because there is various standards of care. If there was no difference in the standards, why do some people say, oh, I go to the best?
Mm.
Because they recognize that there are others who aren't as good.
Excellent. True.
And the rapport that people have with that practitioner is as much part of the treatment as the treatment itself.
Yes. Yeah.
And the same with naturopaths, same with vets, same with chiropractors, same with motor mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
You'll take your car to who you believe will give you the best value for money outcomes.
That's exactly right. And if we didn't do that, I mean, these people come out of the universities with their degrees, with their qualifications, they set up shop, if you like, and they practice what it is that they're trained in. Now, if it didn't have results and people weren't interested, they wouldn't come back, and eventually whatever that practice is would eventually die out, at least in Australia or wherever it may be, and it's gone. But it's gone based on a lack of demand, a lack of results from the consumer, not from
the same way as do fish and chip shops and
yes,
supermarkets.
Except
they
for
either
light,
meet needs
except
or
light
they
bulbs.
Don't.
Except for light
yeah.
bulbs.
And we have a sign in our clinic that says our business has been built by referrals from satisfied clients.
Yes.
We appreciate your feedback. take our card if you're happy. Mm-hmm. And our business is built by referrals from satisfied clients. Now, there's a very, very interesting sort of thing that needs to be noted, and that is condemnation without investigation mm-hmm. is arrogance. Mm-hmm. Condemnation with investigation may be an informed opinion, but it depends on where you seek to do your investigation.
Yes.
And it is very easy for people who are trained in medical science to criticize a science of which they have no knowledge or training. Mm. And a medical practitioner, the hypocrisy of the argument about the Friends of Science in Medicine is that GPs and medical practitioners have formed this thing called the Integrative Medicine Institutes, where they then become prescribers of herbal and other supplementation. Mm-hmm. So if it's good enough for them to use within their field of knowledge, and they're using it as a secondary line mm-hmm. to their main field of knowledge, what's wrong with someone who's made it their primary knowledge
yes.
to use it as well?
Absolutely. Totally agree. That's great. And I would just say to the listeners, at least here in Australia, we've recently had the discussion, the government was toying with the idea of removing unleaded petrol from the petrol stations for various reasons, not giving the consumer the choice, but just taking it away, as they did, of course, in the States with the incandescent light globe and replacing it with the fluoro light globes. They didn't give you the choice. If they were no good, people would just stop buying them. But they said, no, we're not going to do that. Or what's another example? The analog television. There's quite a few examples where things have just been taken away and it hasn't been left to die a natural death but just by choice from the consumer. I would suggest to the listeners, be very suspicious when that happens or when people propose that to happen. I would just maintain a level of suspicion. Why do they want to take it out of our power to make a decision?
One of the things about the change of light bulbs is the incandescent light bulb was easy to dispose of.
Mm-hmm.
But these new fluoros, a lot of them had a mercury
yes.
process in them, which is now creating all sorts of problems for how to dispose of them. So one clever decision philosophically made to support a green or other green argument
mm.
is now creating other issues.
That's right.
And so the important thing, as far as I'm concerned, is when you go to see a practitioner about your health, whether it be a medical practitioner, a naturopathic practitioner, or whatever it might be, you need to make sure that the person is working within the field in which they're trained.
Mm-hmm.
And not moving into areas of which they've got little or no knowledge, and that they've got people who can validate their credibility, such as a recognised organisation that says, okay, this person has got legitimacy within our standing.
Mm-hmm. And so, therefore, the universities are vitally important to the process, right?
Well, I believe so. Here, as I am a natural medicine practitioner, I receive students from the Charles Sturt University, from the School of Pharmacology,
mm-hmm.
to look at how we use herbal and alternate medicines within the field of therapeutic substance. Okay, so I am a host site for a university pharmacy school.
Right.
Now, what happens is when the students have come here, they have seen how the medications, because one of the things I go through is what medications is a person on, because some of those medications cause as many problems as what they can cure.
Mm-hmm.
And same with some herbal medicines. And so you've got your positive and negative lists for all these things.
Mm.
And seeing just where the integration is opens the eyes to those students, because they can see that this medicine, which is a regulated and safe substance according to RIP theory, has still got downsides.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're looking at is sometimes which is the lesser of the two evils. Or, you know, when you're in a situation where you're told you've got to do one thing, sometimes a second opinion will actually give you an alternate that you can embrace more easily.
Mm.
As I think I've said to you in the previous one, that any prescription that anyone makes to promote a healthy health and well-being outcome has to include such things as a dietary shift.
Yes.
You know, because a lot of the problems that we have in our modern societies are basically lifestyle driven.
Yes.
Yep. And medicine is not about lifestyle. Medicine is about the identification, the treatment of symptoms and ailments.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about dealing with causal factors and correction.
Mm, yeah.
So hopefully that gives you a bit of an input as to where I come from.
Mm.
And I like to live in my old farmhouse, which is, you know, my choice. I don't yes. have to live in suburbia.
Yes.
You know, I don't have to have other people telling me what decisions I can make,
mm.
except for things that are going to be harmful to others. Now, if I'm doing something which is harmful to others, there is a right for society to set some standards.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you can't go down the street and drive on the wrong side of the road. You can't run red lights.
Right.
Okay? Mm-hmm. But I can choose which supermarket I go to, what house I build, what car I drive, what food I eat, etc. And I think that those people who are condemning the natural medicines, when they're looking at it from a different perspective, outside of their own training, are being extremely ignorant and arrogant.
Indeed.
To think that we would just accept them face value.
Mm. No, I would agree. And obviously, once again, they're infringing on people's freedom of choice. So thank you for that. Thanks for sharing your insights and opinion on that article, because I'm sure it is an issue even abroad that many can relate to. And we had some comments, Steve. I'm going to read some of these out. And thank you to the listeners for leaving comments. This is from Darren. Darren writes, Johnny, your programs are smoothly running on all eight cylinders. 16 episodes of Bugatti Veyron. Boy, I'd love to have one of those. With the important topics you are addressing for us, especially the Torah. He says, I currently work at a food co-op specializing in organic natural foods and nutritional supplements. I'm relatively new to this change towards a healthier lifestyle, so this talk has been very beneficial for me. This obviously was the discussion you and I had a couple of weeks ago. Not only are food co-ops focused on natural whole foods, but also in fair trade, which promotes better working conditions and trading practices in developing countries around the world. The goal is to protect people from the super giant and powerful food industries who aim to control the market with their unethical trading practices. And thank you, Mr. Tamplin, for sharing your knowledge and information. Well, thank you, Darren, for your comment. And yes, food co-ops, if there's one near you, it's certainly worthwhile getting involved in. Very good idea. And Esther writes, essential topic and precious information. Some folks ask, she writes, why do I need to go organic? My reply is because you only have this one body, and it is constantly bombarded with chemicals that wear out the immune system. Why do I need to drink filtered water? Because chlorine and fluoride cause harm to the body. And then there's the practice of popping a pill in almost any situation with headaches and pains, and yet eating the right food is not important. It's breaking my heart, she says. Thank you, Jono and Stephen, for this program. Shalom. Gracie. Gracie writes, Jono, I'm geeking out over this. More and more and more. Please have him back. That's you, and here you are.
Well, I'm here.
I hope you realize how blessed you are to have this man as your local go-to guy. In all my research to become healthier, I've come across and read a lot of views from different experts in the, quote, natural realm, but most of them seem to have very isolated views on health, very symptoms-based. Mr. Tamplin explained something which I believe is so vitally important for everyone to get. Everybody is different. Just eating healthy food isn't enough. You must eat what's right for you.
That's the key.
That's the key. And certain symptoms can be caused by any number of different deficiencies. Therefore, treating disease-based symptoms, no matter how natural the approach, still does not address the root cause. You must learn your natural nutritional needs. In my opinion, unless we understand these basic principles, we won't have a clue about how to live and eat healthy. On a side note, she writes, I've recently taken up a permanent boycott of sugar. My body won't even tolerate it anymore. My throat gets swollen and scratchy. I get terrible head congestion and feel absolutely lousy from just consuming a small amount. The only sweets I can consume are small amounts of raw honey, real maple syrup, and fruits. Anyway, I'm trying to get others to join me in my protest of sugar, but so far I don't have any takers. Well, I can tell you, Gracie, I'm with you 100%. I'm not a big fan of sugar. In fact, I'm sure we may talk about this at some stage, but eliminating sugar and wheat out of my diet has made an incredible difference. But yeah, we have a little bit of raw honey. In fact, from you, Stephen, we get the manuka honey.
Manuka honey, yeah, that's a good therapeutic honey in many ways. Mm. And honey's not only useful as a sweetener agent, but also as a wound agent. And yes. Various honeys are applied on open ulcers and sores and wounds to promote a nutritive place for healthy cells to grow, mm-hmm. and certainly suffocate off the bad ones, but also it's just creates an area where you've got cleaning going on all the time with the natural organisms in the honey.
Mm.
And it's a very powerful food.
Brilliant. and real maple syrup now, and fruits. This is really the only sugars I have as well. In fact, right now I have in front of me a banana, strawberry, blueberry, kefir, and a little bit of maple syrup smoothie, and it's just absolutely delicious. That's the sweetest thing I'll probably have all day. Oh, well, to be fair, I do, Gracie, you may not approve, but I do have a square of dark organic chocolate from time to time with almonds. That's just one.
It's called All Things in Moderation, Jono.
All Things in Moderation. I like that. And
the thing about fruit is a lot of sweeteners now being fructose-based. Now, fructose mm-hmm. is the natural sugar which occurs in fruit. But fructose in its own right, when you take it in isolation from the fruits it exists in, can create intestinal disturbances because things, as I said before, need cofactors. And fructose can be a bit of a problem when it is used as a concentrated sweetener. But taken as a whole thing, such as you're using the full honey or the full syrup, you know, I like the agave syrup and things of that sort, you're having the whole thing in concentration, as a concentrate of its own self.
In moderation, yeah.
Yeah, but you're not taking the sweetening component out of that. Mm. So that's where, you know, white refined sugar is an extract of molasses, you know. Mm. And so taking the whole thing, the raw sugar, the molasses, is certainly a better way to be. But when you start looking at trying to improve where your outcomes are going, I've said to so many people, give up something like your milk or your sugar or your white bread for a week and then have a serve of it at the end of the week.
Mm.
And you will start to experience the change.
Yes.
And without change, there'll be no change. And if you're already unwell, unless you're prepared to change what you put in, nothing's going to change.
That's right.
Without change, there can be no change. And medications for conditions can't act as nutrients for nutrition depletion conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Only nutrients can act as nutrients. Nutrients can have a therapeutic effect, but a drug cannot have a nutritional effect.
Mm, absolutely. So before I jump off that topic, by the way, with sugar, I will also mention if things must be sweet and people really want sweetener in their food or whatever it may be, we also use stevia. What's your opinion of stevia?
Stevia is a plant, and it's a plant which has got its own innate sweetness, and that's fine. You're using a whole product.
Mm.
Its entirety to serve its natural purpose.
Yeah.
So there's nothing against that. When you go taking extracts out of something, that's when you complicate it.
Yes.
But when you have the entire juices, when you have the entire product in its intended form, it's not going to have an outcome that's too bad for you.
Yes, absolutely. The other thing, of course, is that stevia has it's alkaline as opposed to sugar is rather acidic. And if people have a pH issue, then that's another handy thing to remember.
That's a very important point, that your body's pH is where it'll go wrong. And to talk about osteoporosis, you know, and the calcium depletion that leads to it, what happens in the body is everything we do creates an acid waste.
Yes.
That acid is sequestered in the blood to be filtered through the kidneys. But when the system is acid, the body needs to buffer that through the kidneys. Otherwise, it can cause essentially a chemical burn in the kidneys.
Mm.
So it leaches calcium to act as a buffer and to mildly deacidify those acids, which is why people with high acid systems can get kidney stones, which are a calcium deposit.
Mm.
And osteoporosis and calcium deficiency has got nothing to do with estrogen and everything. It's got more to do with an acid system and the calcium being leached to buffer those acids and basically to soften the acid effect as it goes through the kidney. And so when we start talking about osteoporosis and some of those other acid like arthritis conditions, it's important to first of all get the pH right.
Yes, I have no doubt that you and I will have probably long conversations about pH later in these series of programs.
There's a wealth of information out there on that.
Indeed.
It's a subject where, you know, I've become quite strict in my own clinical work. Everyone who comes in for clinical consultation, I will assess their body's oxygenation and I'll assess their body's pH.
Mm.
As part of the two things, because if you've got poor oxygenation and an acid pH, nothing else I do will come right till they're corrected.
Mm. Yes. Yeah, it's an excellent starting point, absolutely. Sandy writes, very needed topic. I will go to Stephen's website. Once again, that is centralwestnaturopathic.com, and I'll put a link here on the website. So research info on medical conditions that I've been diagnosed with and meds that I am taking for these conditions. Thank you, Jono and Stephen. Well, thank you, Sandy, and thank you, everybody who's left comments there. We also have some questions. Shall we dive headlong into those?
We can have a couple of those. And on the topic of the website, we're about to reconstruct our website, which will actually have information more easily findable in like an indexed manner.
Excellent. Well, we look,
so people will be able to go there and find information more easily than what is there at the moment. And the range of articles will be increased significantly over the next 2 or 3 months.
Marvellous. Well, we look forward to that.
If people have got specific questions, they can always put the email in to that site or through you, whichever they wish, and we'll build that into our future information program.
Grand. Okay. And well, what I'll do is I'll put the link to the website and also your email address if people prefer to contact you that way.
Yep.
So this is now, before we do address any of these questions, we should throw a disclaimer into the mix. Would you like to do that?
Yes. I'm happy to give general information about general inquiry. Specific information about specific conditions is a very different matter. Mm-hmm. And I will neither diagnose or prescribe in absence of the consultation with an individual.
Yes.
It's a very ethical position. It's also a legal position because there are more things than just base information that's given to me that I need to work with.
Yes.
And so while we can discuss in general terms some issues, there are some things that we have to draw a line on, and giving specific diagnosis or prescription over the phone or over the internet or whatever, in the absence of a physical consultation is not a good thing to be doing.
So what this may serve as, you're speculating, giving a general overview, but you need to, the listeners need to take this information, go and find someone who you can talk to in face-to-face so that they can also take that information and do a one-on-one consultation just to make sure that what Stephen says may or may not be suited to them. So that just needs to be said.
Yeah.
Okay. This is from Carol. Carol commented saying that she has stage 2 diabetes and the tablets she takes for it.
Stage 2 or type 2?
Well, I guess that must be type 2.
Type 2, yeah.
Type 2. And they make her stomach swell. And she says, is there a natural way of treating this condition?
Diabetes is an interesting situation. Diabetes type 1, which is the insulin-dependent diabetes mellitus, is a condition where there is a deficiency in the management of insulin and sugar ratios. With diabetes type 2, there is an insulin resistance, and insulin resistance can be brought about by foods we eat, activity we do or don't have, and there are many other contributing factors to diabetes type 2. One of the things about medications for diabetes type 2 is the way that the medications interfere with some of the other normal processes. In other words, they try to regulate, upregulate or downregulate certain body functions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you've got a person whose metabolic rate is moving along at a normal speed, things are traveling through in the right rate, you interfere with that process and you can get some reduction in the way those food processes are going on. But the other thing is it can also alter your what we call osmolality, the fluid balancing of the body between sodium and potassium. There's a pump, and you can be quite disturbed there because the insulin regulation and the kidney regulation are very similar. There are some common minerals in that.
Mm-hmm.
What can happen is you can end up with an intestinal bloating simply by changing the chemical mix. If you're taking medications, the chemical mix in the gut can cause fermentation, gases and so on. On the other hand, you can also get fluid load imbalances, which can give you a fluid bloating of the abdominal area.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at that medication, my advice would be to say, okay, go to, in Australia we have a thing called MIMS, the medical reference. You can go on the internet and you can look up the name of that drug and see what the known side effects are.
Uh-huh.
In some cases it may well be that you just need to have dose regulation, increasing or decreasing certain doses.
Mm-hmm.
You may need to be also taking things at different times of the day. Some things should be taken with food, something should be taken different to food. Mm-hmm. And so when we look at a person taking a medication and then they can relate their discomfort to that medication, we need to look at their compliance with the medication's prescription instruction.
Right.
And whether the dose is right and whether it's right for your condition and what else you are doing that may be contributing. Mm-hmm. For example, there are some foods that you should not take in with some medications. Right. And there are some medications that can't be taken together. And so these are things that I would consider if a person's noticing discomfort associated with a medication, they would need to review the requirements as to how that medication should be taken, the dose of that, and talk to the person who prescribed it about it.
Right, right. So if your stomach is swelling as a result of taking medication, it's not just something that you say, oh, well, I guess I just have to learn to live with that. And obviously there's something wrong and they need to reconsider and look at combinations of things or changing or the medicine.
Yeah, and if one medication is not suitable, maybe another one can assist.
Mm-hmm.
So there's also non-pharmaceutical drugs such as herbal medicines and other things that can be beneficial in assisting in the regulation of the sugar balances of diabetes type 2.
Right. Excellent. So it's definitely something that she should chase up with her medical practitioner.
Yeah, the prescriber should be told about the situation and given the opportunity to make some adjustment.
Excellent. Vicky asks, g'day Vicky, by the way, is there anything nutritional that can reverse autoimmune disease such as Graves' disease? I've never heard of Graves' disease. What's that?
That's to do with the thyroid.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things about the thyroid is it will only absorb iodine properly when the pH is around 7. And if you take some other minerals, you can have a wildly disturbed pH and still absorb certain minerals.
Uh-huh.
But in order to absorb iodine, you need to get your pH back to its optimal value. 6.8 to 7 is where it needs to be. That's the only way you can absorb the iodine, which will then come about the management of thyroid autosomal disorder. Now, with thyroid, you've got 3 or 4 different hormone functions and antibodies that are to be considered. But when it all boils down to the ability of the thyroid to do its job properly, and it's an iodine-regulated gland,
mm-hmm.
you have to have the pH right for the iodine to be right,
right,
for the thyroid to have a chance of doing its own job.
Uh-huh.
And when you look at the link between the adrenals, the thyroid, and the hypothalamus, which work in a biofeedback loop, then you need to consider other things like gender hormones and adrenal outputs, exhaustions, and stresses mm-hmm. that can also be bringing a person down into a systemic or an endocrine collapse. Neuroendocrine studies have been done for a long time, and the relationship between minerals and endocrine function are very clearly defined. And in relationship to those minerals, minerals are absorbed at specific pH values.
Right.
So it's not looking at the effect end, which is the Graves.
Mm-hmm.
It's a matter of looking at the cause end.
Which may be the pH.
pH and neuroendocrine mineral balance.
Excellent. So once again, there's a place to start is your pH level. And I mean, here we've got a packet of pH strips. We check our pH regularly. It's an excellent idea to get some pH strips and get into the habit of checking your pH from time to time. And if you're too acidic, then you need to look at your diet and see what the problem is, where you can change. Now, by the way, now you have a list, don't you? You have a list of alkaline foods and acidic foods. I'm sure you gave me a list once. Is that on the website?
Yeah. Acid foods and alkaline foods are a very important balance. And we need to be aiming for about 80% alkaline intake to maintain a good, healthy value. That doesn't mean you can't have some acid inputs. We do need some acid inputs, but we need to make sure that we choose from the things that are going to give us an alkaline outcome, because that's where our pro-health state is.
That's right. So I think that is available on your website, if I remember correctly.
I believe that should be there.
But
they're very simple reference points.
Excellent. She also asks, how's this? She asks, how about someone with polycystic ovarian syndrome causing infertility type A, blood type A?
Okay, well, polycystic ovarian syndrome is a very interesting thing, because you don't actually have to have polycystic ovaries to have a polycystic ovarian syndrome. What it is, it's another way of saying there's estrogen dominance. And during the menstrual cycle, in the early part of the month,
mm-hmm.
post the menstruation, there is a very low level of progesterone and a much higher level of estrogen. At ovulation, around about day 14, the egg is released from the ovarian follicle and the progesterone level shoots high. If the conception occurs, then the progesterone level stays high. If conception doesn't occur, then the progesterone falls off very quickly and then estrogen dominance takes place again. What happens in polycystic ovarian syndrome and infertility situations is there is an insufficiency of progesterone usually to start with, but the estrogen dominance remains higher than the progesterone load that you need, which is where you could also relate to minerals, because in estrogen dominance, you'll be copper dominant. In progesterone, it'll relate to zinc. And that's why a lot of girls, they get pimples prior to their period because they've lost their progesterone. They're losing zinc. They're copper dominant. And so they get the pimpling and the headaches and the tensions that go with it. Whereas in order to assist women who've got this polycystic ovarian syndrome, the need is to improve the progesterone function. And there are some very good herbs for that. And here in my clinic, I find wild yam and Vitex agnus castus a good starting point. On top of that, there are dietary means to ensure that the right levels of zinc are being acquired. That could be achieved through use of seafoods, could be used in minerals, the vegetables such as spinach and nuts and things which have got very good mineral levels. And so those sort of things can support your body instead of having this estrogen dominance. And it just brings things back into a more comfortable balance from which fertility can occur, because I very rarely find highly stressed people getting pregnant.
Sure.
Because their body is running on the wrong hormones. And so you need to basically take a two-pronged approach. One is to get the nutrient base right, and the other one is to get the mindset right.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you for that. Eddie asks, what was the name of the thing that Stephen says he takes in gel cap form? Now, if I remember correctly, I think you said you take a garlic.
Garlic gel caps, yep.
Yes, okay. Now, what people can get this from, this is available at your shop, obviously. Where,
well, we have it here, but it's a fairly common presentation for things like your garlic oils and your fish oils. Some of the gelatin capsules, which had been used in the past, or veggie capsules, which had been used in the past, as soon as they reach the mouth and it gets warm, the product explodes in your mouth and can give you a rather yuck taste. Right. So the gel cap just takes a little bit longer to be melted in your stomach.
Sure.
And gel caps need to be taken with a cool drink, simply because the product, again, if it gets in touch with the hot drink, will be released too quickly. And then the oils will float to the top, and then you'll be repeating that all day.
Okay.
So I find with gel caps, you know, I'll have that probably with the first or second mouthful of food and a cool drink.
Yes.
And then I'll put the rest of my food on top of it to make sure it melts, goes down the right way and passes through to the right pipes.
Sounds good. So now this is, now this raises a question, actually, and it just popped into my head, particularly on this program, eating kosher is vitally important, and gel caps, is there a possibility that gel caps come from a pig-based gelatin? Is that why some people take veggie caps?
That is one reason why a lot of people will use veggie caps. But what you'll find is that different manufacturers are aware of the different requirements of population groups. And so you'll have gluten-free capsules, you'll have vegetable capsules, you'll have a range of capsules, which you need to look at the label and just see what is contributing to that product.
Because I think sometimes they will specify that it's bovine-based gelatin, sourced from a cow, basically, rather than something that may not be kosher. So that's also something worth taking into consideration. Janine. G'day, Janine. She asks, thank you so much. She says, thank you so much, Stephen and Jono. This program is what all of us need. I have been diagnosed with heart disease. The doctors put me on all kinds of medicines, and my condition has become worse. I have stopped all medicines and started to look at my diet and exercise. I have no blood pressure or cholesterol problems anymore. However, I do have a problem with water retention, which is very bad on my left side from my neck down to my feet. What can I do? I was told that it is because of the damage to my heart. Please help. That's Janine.
That may be so. Now, okay, well, with heart disease, those two words cover a wide range of issues. And without knowing more detail, then it's very hard to be of much help, except that if there's fluid retention, that would indicate that there's either a loss of muscular tone or there's some valvular weakness on one side of the heart, which is preventing the fluid being properly pushed forward. so that it can get the pressure it needs to go through the kidneys and properly released. But the issue that comes back to the sort of core of it is that one of the things that alters our electrical impulsing of the muscles of the heart and the regulation of the heart efficiencies is a thing called oxidative stress. Now, oxidative stress occurs when there is a molecular unit with an unpaired electron in the outer branch. Now, if you go back to your basic chemistry, you've got your atom, which has got a nucleus with a proton and a neutron, and then it's got the electrons all around it spinning, and they should be equally balanced. And then these come out as what they call free radicals. And free radicals go looking for that extra electron. And to do so, they tend to attack blood vessels and heart muscle because that's where they can get the richest source of supply. And when you get a person who has a lot of free radical damage, one of the first indicators of that is atrial fibrillation. And that's even shown up now in the medical texts how atrial fibrillation needs antioxidant medication rather than cardiac medication because it's a whole systemic thing. And when the heart muscle is being under attack from free radicals, then, of course, heart disease can occur. The other thing that happens with cholesterol depositing is the blood vessels are meant to be like a smoothly polished tube inside. But due to free radical damage, these tubes become like rough edges, like unplaned timber, you know, like raw timber. They've got these sharp edges hanging out.
Yeah, splinters.
And then the cholesterol comes along to do its job, which is to putty up those rough edges. So you get the smoothness back. Unfortunately, it then builds up and builds up and builds up. And the most significant thing about it is that these internal or the lumen of the arteries and the blood vessels becomes rough as a result of a subclinical deficiency of vitamin C. And vitamin C is our most powerful antioxidant. So it's our free radical scavenger.
Well, that's interesting because when you say antioxidant, I think of this will tell you something about me. I think of dark chocolate, and I think
I like to think of red wine.
Yeah, red wine and herbal teas as well.
That's right. But your three main antioxidants, or four if you go to the full hog, are selenium, vitamin C, and vitamin E. Vitamin A, and you often see vitamin ACE, antioxidant ACE. Vitamin A has very little antioxidant potential as the beta-carotene, which does, but it doesn't sort of sound right when you say beta-carotene CE. They say ACE because it's easier. But the antioxidant component of cardiac disease management is imperative as one of your first stages. And so you can actually do a free radical urine test. We can do them here in clinic. There's a company which produces these kits, and if you look up on the internet, you may find free radical self-test kits. You can send off, get those, do your urine test, and you can actually measure your free radical load, and then you can start to work out what you need to do in respect of that.
Very interesting. Excellent.
A cardiac disease is usually a consequence of free radical damage arising from a mineral or a vitamin deficiency.
Excellent.
And then the cholesterol does its job. And so you can see that if you're going to suppress cholesterol by taking cholesterol-inhibiting medications, your body can't repair itself.
So it creates another problem elsewhere, right?
That's right. And what we're seeing is that the rise in homocysteine, which is implicated in the onset of Alzheimer's, is due to some of the medications inhibiting the processing of folic acid, which is necessary to neutralize homocysteine. So it builds up as a gunge in the brain and sets up these short circuits.
There it is.
Of Alzheimer's and so on. So there's a whole lot of other things that go as part of the process. But if there's any issues with heart disease or any of those issues, you've got to look back at radicals and you've got to look back at your vitamin C and your total nutritional state.
Excellent. All right. Thank you for that. Marsha, I have no idea. Marsha says, I have a granddaughter with sickle cell. She had a stroke. I don't know what that is. She had a stroke at the age of 5.5. Now she gets a blood transfusion once a month. The poor dear. Now, because of the blood transfusion, she has an iron overload in her system. We would want to know if there's anything out there in a natural form to set her free from blood transfusions. The doctor here in Atlanta, Georgia, tell us that once she is 18 years old, they will have to stop the blood transfusions. My granddaughter is now 13 years old. What is sickle cell?
Sickle cell is a type of anemia where instead of having nicely rounded biconcave disc red blood cells, they're forming almost in the shape of a sickle, you know, the old sickle that they used to carry into warfare and do the gardening with.
Sure.
Cutting grasses. So they're the sickles. And so the blood cell takes on a different shape. And because of its change of shape, what it's doing is it can't travel down the blood vessels and evenly give off oxygen. So sickle cell anemia is where, due to the distorted shape of the blood cell, you're not able to get adequate oxygen perfusion. And so, therefore, you can end up having a stroke because your body needs oxygen to survive. Without oxygen, the cells die.
Right.
Now, the ongoing transfusional state is interesting because when you have a blood transfusion, the first thing about a blood transfusion is that it's a volume expander in the urgent cases, but it takes 3 or 4 days for the blood to be properly metabolized to be useful in the body. Now, when you have too many transfusions and you're not being able to metabolize, then the iron component can create a thing called hemochromatosis, and that can then give you this iron overload process. And the iron overload is one of the reasons a lot of people here give blood. So if you've got hemochromatosis, you donate blood. And so when you look at sickle cell and all these things, in the Caucasian body, the body needs folic acid, B12, and iron in the right ratios to produce a healthy cell. When you've got any of these distortions of cell membrane, then you've got a problem in the DNA production of those cells, which is folic acid and vitamin B12 dependent. Now, in respect of sickle cell, there's a little bit more to it than that, because there's usually some tie into some of the other racial issues, which some races are more prone to sickle cell anemias than others, and some have serious complications as a result. But either way, it's not a good thing to have. And the follow-up with the starting point to me would be to go back to what's necessary to produce good cells, and that's healthy bone marrow, and the bone marrow requiring the support of cell development nutrients, B12, folic acid, and iron as a starting point. But if you've already got an iron overload, then you don't want the iron.
Sure.
So the B12 and folic acid is a key point to being able to make a start to some well-being, I would hope.
Excellent. Yes, we certainly hope so. I hope, Marcia, that your granddaughter gets some positive results soon. Samuel asks, Jono, great session. Love what you're doing with Truth to You. Keep it coming, brother. Stephen, I have dizzy spells. Not so much the world is revolving around me, but I get lightheaded often at times at looking at the computer screen too long, or getting up and moving around. Sometimes I'll just be walking and I get lightheaded. It doesn't seem to be keeping me down when I'm doing physical activities, although I may lose my balance at times. Any help would be appreciated. Thanks to both you guys.
Dizzy spells can occur for several reasons. One is blood pressure dropping, and if a person's fairly inactive, then you're going to get pooling of the blood in the lower organs. That's what people faint from, because they're standing still, there's no activity, the muscles aren't pulsing, so therefore the blood pools in the feet or some other part, they collapse. When they're laying down flat, of course, the blood goes back to the brain, they recover. Another reason why people can get dizzy spells is if there's a disturbance in the labyrinth of the ear, which is the organ which regulates our sense of balance and perspective and orientation. That can be associated with viral or bacterial infections and things. Other things that can be contributing to it is low blood sugar, of course. If a person's getting a lot of sugar load variation or glucose variations, that can also contribute to it. And I'd be asking a couple of questions first. Diarrhoea, when they occur, in respect of what's been happening, how long since you ate? What did you eat? What you ate, and things of that sort. You'll then be able to relate them to some aspects of activity or foods, because some foods have got what we call a vasodilative effect. They can open up your blood vessels, and warming foods can do that. And if it is associated with activities or inactivities, then you may find that before you get up and move around, you can just do some gentle shoulder rolling activity to raise the blood pressure a bit. If it's while you're focusing on the screen, you can also get certain brainwave changes. because the vision, the eyes, are receiving impulses. So there's a whole lot of things that go with it. But I would start by diarising how and when and what, a little bit more detailed.
Yes, excellent. All right. Well, that look, thank you to the listeners who sent in the questions and the comments. We do appreciate those. Thank you so much, Stephen Tamplin, for your time. You're very generous with your time. Once again, listeners, the website is www.centralwestnaturopathic.com. I will put a link on there also with Stephen's email address. And until next time, dear listener, remember, and I'm going to take a quote from your website, my friend, it's never too late to make positive changes.
That's what I like.
It is.
Okay, Johnny.
Cheerio. Bye-bye.
I'll say goodnight now.